I'm Virginia Prescott, and On Second Thought is back here on Georgia Public Broadcasting. Over the summer, we built a team and we hit the road and we crossed the state to talk with listeners and citizens about their lives in today's South. And one of the things we heard frequently has been floated by political junkies, pollsters, and headlines for years. Georgia is turning blue. So with an influx of new voters and the high national profile of Stacey Abrams' gubernatorial campaign, Democrats are hoping 2016 will be the year to turn the solidly red tide of Georgia's electorate. Now, we're not going to go deep in with the Abrams and Kemp race, but we're exploring what has become kind of a talking point and maybe even an assumption about who Georgia voters are. With GPB's own Bill Nygut here in the studio, he's going to put some context on some of the most interesting and hotly contested races in a long time. Bill, great to have you with us.
It's really wonderful to be here, Virginia. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks for being here. Also with us, Perry Bakins Jr. He's a senior writer for 538. That's the online publication using statistical analysis to understand elections. He's joining us from Louisville, Kentucky. Perry, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Perry, just after the Georgia primary, you published a piece under the headline, Can Stacey Abrams Turn Georgia Blue? So you write, Georgia's still a red state. Republicans control all the major statewide offices. So Stacey Abrams is an underdog. How much of an underdog, Perry?
I mean, the polls show a very close race within the margin of error. I think it's like 45-45. And I think the core dynamics here are really hard in that Donald Trump won Georgia by 5%. Georgia's electorate not only leans to the right, but it's what we call sort of inelastic, meaning that, it, you know, in a state like Iowa or Pennsylvania, you have a lot of people that are sort of are swing voters, and you might have Democrats win one year, Republicans win another year. At least up to now, last 20 years in some ways, Georgia's electorate has been pretty stably Republican. And the other factor is you have a very deep sort of racial polarization where, you know, in 2014, Michelle Nunn, the Senate candidate, won about 25% of the white vote. Democrats in other states win 30, 40, sometimes 50% of the white vote, but it seems like in Georgia they have a hard time getting more than a quarter of the white vote. And it's really hard to win the electorate, which is majority white in Georgia, if you're only getting 25% of the white vote if you're a Democratic candidate.
Now, Bill, you've spent a lot of time watching national politics and Georgia politics.
Yeah.
He referred to that Michelle Nunn election. So what are you seeing here? Can you give us a snapshot of the last time Georgia was blue?
Yeah. Well, the last time Georgia was blue was way back in 2001, 2002. All of the constitutional offices, meaning everybody from governor down to insurance commissioner, labor commissioner, all of those races were held by Democrats. The legislature was a Democratic legislature. And then the earthquake occurred. In 2002, Democrat Roy Barnes lost re-election, shockingly, to Republican Sonny Perdue. First time a Republican had held that office since Reconstruction. And we're not even sure about that because we can't be certain there was ever somebody who was really a Republican in the
right.
governor's office. And that began the entire change. The other thing that happened in 2002 that presaged what was to come was that longtime Speaker of the House, Thomas B. Murphy, a giant in politics, having served in that job for almost three decades, was defeated in his own House race out in Bremen, Georgia. And although the Democrats continued to control the legislature for another couple of years, it was really clear at that moment things were about to change.
Well, so what presaged that? What changed the course for Perdue and Barnes to win?
I think Perry talks about it really, really well. And by the way, Perry, we talk about 538 on our show, Political Rewind, all the time. You guys are just a wonderful resource for us. So I'm really happy to get to be on the show with you. But what we used to call yellow dog Democrats, those white voters, many of them rural, who would not elect a Republican, even if a yellow dog were running in the Democratic Party, began to see their real conservative roots. The party started to split. Democrats began increasingly being a party for African-American voters. Rural voters in Georgia started thinking that Republicans were more representative of their points of view, which is in part what led to Roy Barnes' loss. So, I mean, I think we saw the bifurcation, white voters going Republican, African-Americans going Democrat, which is why what Perry says is so important. If you can't get more than 25% of the white vote, it's hard to win a statewide election here.
Well, all right, Perry, you said Georgia inelastic, but we're hearing a lot of assertions just like this one.
Donald Trump looking to turn blue states red come November, but according to analysts, one state that may be heading in the opposite direction is Georgia.
One of the places with the most dramatic change underway is Georgia.
The state that President Trump visited today, Georgia, has voted Republican in the last six presidential elections, but there is a new movement to turn the red state blue.
So you asked, could Stacey Abrams turn Georgia blue? The Atlantic, Politico, all drumming up this idea that the GOP is losing its hold on voters through the past 20 years. Now, why is this the angle, Perry, that the national media are biting on?
Well, this is an interesting race in that we have a couple things going on here. First of all, Abrams is the first, potentially the first black female candidate, black female governor in American history. So that'd be a big deal. But I think the second thing is going on here is I do think there's evidence that Georgia, if you look at what happened in Virginia, which has went from being red to pretty much strongly blue, look at North Carolina, which is closely divided, but is like a state. The governor of North Carolina is a Democrat now. Trump won the state. Two is that you have a combination of states like Georgia, North Carolina, and Virginia, which are have growing minority populations, which means the Latinos, Asians, and blacks, and also this divide between college-educated whites and non-college-educated whites is a huge divide that's growing in this Trump era. So you could see a scenario where the college-educated whites, who I assume are concentrated in the Atlanta area, are turning from Republicans in a lot of other areas. We're seeing this in Virginia. We saw this in the special election in Alabama. So there's a case to be made that the Trump dynamic particularly is pulling college-educated whites away from the Democratic Party and the country is diversifying at the same time, where I do think those two factors, and the fact that Trump is fairly unpopular in overall, and it's a midterm, I do think those things make this a different kind of race than, say, 2014, where the president's party was the Democrats, and I thought it was very unlikely Michelle Nunn was going to win this race. This is a different dynamic right now, and I do think Abrams' benefits from changes in the political dynamic that's sort of since 2016.
So let's bring us back to that 2014 governor's race, Bill. Former state senator Jason Carter, grandson of President Jimmy Carter, ran against Nathan Deal. So what kind of campaign did he run, and how did this dynamic change?
Well, here's one of the things that's really changed in a significant way. Perry, of course, Perry's right. The fact that we have a black candidate, female candidate for governor, people are spending a lot of time talking about that, and it's truly important. But here's the other important thing that distinguishes Stacey Abrams from the way that both Michelle Nunn and Jason Carter ran in their races in 2014. Abrams, from the very beginning, staked out a position as an authentic progressive Democrat. She did not shy away and try to somehow be a conservative Democrat. Jason Carter, for instance, didn't embrace any form of gun control. He was all for guns. And I think we saw a little bit of that in this primary election and what the consequences could be when you had Abrams running as a genuine progressive against Stacey Evans, the Democrat who thought she could reconstitute that yellow dog Democrat base, and ended up getting beaten very, very badly. So I think it's not just that she's African-American. She's running as a genuine progressive Democrat. So that's why this race is going to be so interesting to watch.
That's GPB's own Bill Nigut, who's been watching elections and saw Georgia voters fall solidly red as of the beginning of this century, 2002. He's with us in the studio. Perry Bacon Sr. is senior writer for 538. And he says Stacey Abrams' chances are better than her Democratic predecessors, but still here and here, Perry, sounds like a long shot.
I don't think she's a long shot at all. I think this is a very close race. I think she might lose by 2%. I mean, I don't think it's a long shot. I think if I had to bet money, I would bet money on Kemp as a Republican state. But I don't think she's a long shot at all. I think the key thing to watch here is that Abrams is running a campaign with the argument that we're going to try to like register every minority voter we can. I've heard that before in Georgia, but she does have more experience doing that. She used to run this voter registration group. She is black. I think that does matter in terms of getting black turnout out. You've seen some of these like resistance groups emerge in Georgia as well. So I don't think she's a long shot. I think the big challenge is the runoff rules in Georgia are such if Abrams could win 48% to 47%, that's one thing. But you actually have to get 50% in Georgia. And I do feel like that's going to be a – I can see her, like, you know, coming in a close second or even winning the initial race. And then in the runoff, the Republican Party can really organize. Donald Trump can probably show up in Georgia. If this becomes like a runoff race in December, I have a hard time seeing Abrams win that race, because then the whole Republican apparatus can organize against her in a certain way.
So, Bill, I want to pull back for a second. It seems like the cradle of the optimism of is Georgia's 6th and 7th congressional districts. Now, we remember last year when John Ossoff competed against Representative Karen Handel in the most expensive race in congressional history, but did not flip the 6th, as the saying goes. So he hoped. Why did people think that he could do it?
Well, part of the reason is that in the 6th District, a portion of that district is Cobb County, which has long traditionally been a Republican county, went for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. That was a huge sea change. And in the 7th District, Gwinnett County is a major part of that district. That county, too, always Republican, voted for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. So that's one of the reasons that Democrats see some hope there. I think that their optimism ought to be restrained. I mean, it is certainly Lucy McBath is, again, running as a genuine progressive Democrat. Remember, she's long been associated with gun control national movements because she lost her son tragically to a gun incident. So I think she's going to put up a good fight. But I still think that in those districts, what happens is Republicans come home. And I think those races are likely to be very, very close. It's certainly possible that the Democrats could pull them both out. But I'm not sure, while the demographics are shifting, I'm not sure they've shifted enough this time to overcome the Republican advantages in those districts.
So why do you think the Democratic Party is riding this wave or putting so much hopes and so much money?
Well, but that's, I think, the best thing Democrats have going for them is great energy. They're energized, excited. They think they have opportunities here. And they do. I just would caution that those districts are likely to be Republican, but with the right kind of enthusiasm and turnout, Democrats can win.
Okay, so Perry, before you go, you've done the math. So what exactly is it going to take for Stacey Abrams to win in November to turn the state blue? And is that a lasting idea, a lasting legacy?
I don't think it's a lasting thing. I think even if Stacey Abrams won this race, I would still make Donald Trump the favorite against, you know, the Democratic candidate in 2020. I do think a presidential election polarizes people even more. And because I think the Abrams path, I think, is some Republicans don't turn out. They're not that excited about the race. Every Democrat shows up everywhere because they hate Donald Trump so much. You know, she gets really high black turnout. She gets like 30% of the white vote, something like that. She does better in the rural areas than you would think, because some combination of she gets some white votes, she gets strong turnout among rural African Americans and rural Latinos. That's the path I see, is like really high black turnout. She does somewhat better in rural areas. She does really well in like Gwinnett and the counties around Atlanta. And I think there's a path there. It's a hard one, but it's not impossible. And I do think but I don't think there's any sort of permanent blueing of this state this soon. Maybe, but the thing to watch for is eventually what happened in
Perry,
Virginia.
I'm going to wrap you up there so we can move on. Perry Bacon Jr., senior writer for 538. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And Bill Nigut, host of Political Rewind. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Now, just ahead, the political future of Georgia. But first, the strategy that made the South red and the man who mastered it. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, we're digging into predictions that Georgia is turning blue. Like much of the Deep South, the state fell reliably in the Democrat column for most of the 20th century. But Republicans have held the state house and legislature since 2003 and 2005, respectively. One prevailing theory for that shift? The Southern strategy. Targeted messages and tactics used by the GOP to realign the loyalty of white Southern Dixiecrats beginning in the Civil Rights era. Well, we're getting one view on the Southern strategy from Stefan Forbes, who made a prize-winning film about Lee Atwater.
Lee understood the power of image and how American symbols resonate with a lot of Southerners and a lot of people all over the country.
Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story, follows the man whose tactics have stamped American politics ever since. Stephon Forbes, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the Southern strategy, if you could summarize it for us?
In the Southern strategy, you never talked about race explicitly. That was the whole key. It was plausible deniability. So you came up with code words like busing or fair housing legislation, things that actually were wedge issues for white people in the North, because it was easy for most white people to get behind ending Jim Crow. But things that touched suburban New York or Chicago, you know, you could win over these Reagan Democrats to the Republican Party. And if you look at the effect of that, the school system in New York is still separate and unequal, you know, 100 years after slavery. So this stuff worked. It forestalled real political change. And the best thing about it was you could always say it never worked. It never existed. And people still do that today, even though you had heads of the RNC like Ken Melman and Michael Steele apologize for the Southern strategy. People still deny that it was ever used.
Yes. Barry Goldwater's biographer wrote, "It is a way to win the vote of racists without sounding like racists." And into this backdrop, after decades of that, comes Lee Atwater, Atlanta-born, raised in South Carolina, a young Republican. Help paint a picture of this character.
You know, Lee's favorite thing was being misunderestimated by his opponents. They saw him as a dumb country boy, you know, barefoot, guitar-picking Southerner who, you know, he went to Newberry College, just barely a college. He didn't grow up in Harvard Yard. Everything that they saw as his shortcoming and his weakness, Lee Atwater turned into a strength. And before he was done, he completely revolutionized American politics and had a huge hand in the Southernification of the GOP.
In the film, the people that you speak to portray him more as an opportunist than an ideologue. What did you discover about his motivation?
Well, yeah, I mean, the best political operatives have, shall we say, a moral flexibility that allows them to do whatever it's going to take to win. You know, he was completely Machiavellian. Some people thought he could have become a Democrat just as easily, but he saw this huge youth gap in the Republican Party. And he realized this was the place to get ahead. This was the way to make a career. And when he did, it was really a decision that changed America. And I'm sure we'll get into the amazing transformation that he wreaked on our country. It's incredible what this one guy did. And it's ironic, too, that a lot of Democrats still don't really know who he was, and they don't know how to fight the campaign tactics that he pioneered in presidential elections.
The 1988 campaign of George H.W. Bush was where Atwater really made his mark. What made him so effective?
Well, you know, it's still one of the greatest come-from-behind victories in American political history. George Herbert Walker Bush, this elitist, kind of wussy, wimpy guy perceived as a totally ineffectual leader, was down 17 points after the Democratic convention. People had written him off. They were talking about President Dukakis. And Lee pulled off a feat of political jujitsu that is stunning. And the way he did it was by bringing Southern stump politics, which were really the province of local, state, and congressional races, into presidential politics for really the first time in 100 years.
And what does Dukakis do? Every time he stands up, he attacks George Bush. He's a hypocrite. We all know that. You know it, too. That is reflective of the kind of out-of-touch crowd they are. They probably sat up in Brookline eating Belgium endives and a quiche out of the can.
He knew that he had to make things ugly. He had to use wedge politics, the politics of fear. He had to impugn Dukakis's manhood the way people would do on a stump down south. And he knew that these people from Harvard Yard, like Susan Estrich, would have no idea how to combat this stuff. It didn't work so well with Clinton and James Carville 4 years later, who had studied this stuff happening. But in 1988, it was a knockout punch.
He did play up his own regions, the southern regions' mistrust of these eastern elites. Did it hit its mark?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, it's one of the great feats of political rhetoric that the party that was always helping the working class got rebranded as these Volvo-driving, Chardonnay-sipping liberal elites. You know, it's something that's still working today. It's yielding incredible fruit in politics, and the Democrats still don't really know how to come back against that stuff. But it was the politics of resentment that Lee understood incredibly well. And ironically, if the Democrats had learned from Atwater, hadn't just written him off and looked down on him morally, which is understandable, they'd know how to fight against a guy like Donald Trump. Donald Trump calling Jeff Sessions a dumb Southerner. Here's a guy with a law degree. He's the highest ranking law enforcement official in the land. You're going to impugn him like that and, you know, calling him mentally retarded. That strikes such a deep chord across the South. That's Lee Atwater could have gone to town with that. And this is, these are essential parts of American political discourse that the Democrats still don't understand how deep those veins of resentment run.
We're getting a masterclass on a master of the Southern strategy with Stefan Forbes, who produced and directed the 2008 documentary Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story. So Atwater helped to plant rumors about Elizabeth Dole during the primaries, trying to cut away at the leads or popularity of Bob Dole. But as you point out, particularly pointed in the post-convention general election against Dukakis. Now, you said Dukakis up 17 points during the Atlanta convention, but that number decreased following this disturbing ad.
Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
Willie Horton, the prisoner mentioned there, became infamous, an African-American man. So clearly playing race in this game, was that the deciding factor in the 1988 Bush-Dukakis election?
You know, I don't think you can ever point to one deciding factor. They accused his wife, Kitty Dukakis, of burning a flag. President Reagan accused Michael Dukakis of insanity. I mean, it was all part and parcel of the politics of personal destruction. They went to Texas and told everyone that Dukakis was going to take everyone's gun away. But there were interesting things going on underneath the surface. In that campaign, Lee Atwater was the first to also recognize the incredible political potential of the candidate's son, George W. Bush, who had a drinking problem and who had never really amounted to much. And it's amazing in the film, we kind of get to look at this footage of W. growing up under Lee's expert tutelage and becoming this bare-knuckled political brawler. It's an amazing transformation. And for Atwater to do that, he was incredibly guilty about having done that. He was a guy who idolized black musicians, who kind of saw himself as a figure that could bridge these two worlds. He palled around with James Brown and B.B. King. And I know that personally, for him as a Southerner to do this, it was painful, but he knew that this was the way to win.
So against that, we have the seemingly conflicting message of Atwater from a tape here speaking in 1981. Now, this tape was handed over to James Carter IV, and we do warn you the sentiment is pretty offensive.
You start out in 1954 by saying by 1968, you can't say it hurts your backfire, so you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes. And all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites.
So there's Atwater in 1981. N-word is what he's saying there. Stefan Forbes, how do you reconcile these two sides of this man?
You know, as a Southerner, he knew what would work in national presidential elections. You know, we inherit this toxic legacy as Americans. The politics of fear have been practiced on us for centuries. And, you know, our internal guilt at the violence that we've done to black people is transmogrified into this projection of all these evil values onto them as predators, as, you know, criminals. And so You know, racism hurts white Americans in this really devious way. Atwater understood the subtleties of that. He knew how to play upon those fears without really doing it overtly. And, you know, it's unfortunately, it took a Southerner who really understood these views to bring them back into the mainstream of American politics to the point where once it started working so well, it became almost inevitable that these kind of tactics would be used and that we would get a Donald Trump calling white nationalists very fine people and using the playbook of the boogeyman to just totally concentrate political power in the era that we're living in now. It's quite disturbing.
Well, Lee Atwater was diagnosed with a brain tumor. He apologized for his depiction of Willie Horton and things that he said about Michael Dukakis. Now, this was shortly before he died. Do the people you interviewed for the film think that Lee Atwater was sincere in those apologies?
You know, like everything else about the guy, that is a totally divisive topic. You know, he was terrified that he was going to hell for the things he had done. Were they explicitly racial? Was it the politics of personal destruction? People like Mary Madeline believe that, you know, ironically, Lee, who had demonized so many other people, has been demonized since his death, that his political acumen, his insight into the power of class as well as race, and his, you know, incredible political jujitsu, his joyful kind of assuming of the mantle of bad boy, you know, was a way of signaling to the press with a wink and a nod that, you know, these things are okay. It's the way politics is done. He did a lot to legitimize these really nasty tactics in the Washington political establishment. And, you know, a lot of his defenders feel that, ironically, he's been demonized for that since his death. And letting other people off the hook, you know, you got to wonder when Trump is gone, how fast, you know, Republicans will be dropping him like a hot potato and saying, you know, he happened to win. We didn't like any of that stuff. The fact is it delivered them electoral victories and it's given them seats on the Supreme Court and wholesale rewriting of the tax code. There are fruits of these tactics of racism and divisiveness. And we have to be really clear that when you engage in this kind of politics, you're going to be called out on it.
Well, Barbara Bush famously disliked Lee Atwater. She thought he was crude. He definitely broke political norms. Is that part of the Lee Atwater legacy? And what has that meant for politics since?
Lee Atwater was a godsend for George Herbert Walker Bush, one of the waspiest of GOP candidates. He was a throwback to the Rockefeller Republicans. He really couldn't win in 1988. Lee, who loved professional wrestling, he read the National Enquirer. He had a Fellini-esque sense of the American electorate. He was able to coat this patrician wasp with the patina of cowboy boots and Texas cowboy hats. And he was able to paint George Bush as a flag-waving redneck, which was an incredible achievement. And Lee welcomed in a whole new class of people into the GOP. He used W as his point man to outreach to Southern evangelicals who had been really resistant to enter politics, to bring politics into the pulpit. Lee created a political juggernaut down South by giving his party's really questionable economic and racial tactics the moral a sort of moral blessing from the pulpit. I think you can see Lee Atwater's massive effect in American politics, most simply in the character of our president today. In 2016, the thought of President Donald Trump was a joke to most Americans. Back in 1988, Lee actually suggested him as VP to George Herbert Walker Bush, who wrote about it in his diary, said it was strange and unbelievable. Lee saw even back then where American politics was heading and where he was planning to drag it, that the key things would be a resentment against elites, this everyman outsider attitude, blunt talk, racial animus, a killer instinct, and a tabloid sensibility. You could see it all in Donald Trump.
The Kingmaker, as one of your guests called him.
Yeah.
thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Stefan Forbes is producer and director of Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story. And that 2008 film is now having a remarkable resurgence. You can watch a trailer at gpbnews.org. And we want to know what you think. Are you hearing or seeing campaign tactics and messages designed to scare white voters? Leave us a message at 404-500-9457, or you can reach us on Twitter or in our Facebook group. Now, with that historic perspective behind us, we're going to look at some real numbers and trends as we give predictions that Georgia's turning blue a second thought. That's just ahead on GPB. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tomorrow, we tantalize the taste buds with collard greens and bugs. We're going to debut our series of traditional and contemporary takes on essential Southern ingredients. But first, we would love to hear from you. What is the must-have Southern food or dish that you love to make? Tell us the story behind it. You can leave us a voicemail at 404-500-9457. You can find us on Twitter or on Facebook, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 for more. But today, we are talking about Georgia's political history and strategies designed to sway voters in the South. Changing voter demographics and the rise of women candidates nationally has some folks convinced that 2018 is the year Georgia turns blue. Well, we asked you to weigh in. Sam Jones has lived in Georgia for more than 20 years.
I think Georgia's turning blue. I think we're definitely seeing a shift, and I don't think it's going to slow down anytime soon as Georgia continues to grow and Georgia continues to give voices to the minorities that haven't been well represented in the past.
Well, how likely is that shift? We're looking at some of the numbers with Emory University professor Andra Gillespie. Andra, welcome.
Thank you.
And also with us is Atlanta Journal-Constitution political reporter Greg Bluestein. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Andra, I'm going to start with you because you studied work on reverse migration. That is one possible reason for political shifts in Georgia. But first, what is reverse migration?
So between 1910 and 1970, demographers note that there was a mass exodus of African Americans out of the South, where they had previously been enslaved, to industrial centers in the North and in the West. And so a couple of generations removed from that great migration in the aughts, demographers started to note that many African Americans were moving from the North and the West back to the South. So they were coming seeking economic job opportunities in booming cities like Atlanta and Charlotte. And people were returning back to their ancestral homelands for retirement. And so during the 2000s, there was this discussion of an increase in the African American population in the South, where there were already plenty of Blacks. That hasn't always been pretty consistent or even, but we could just look at census numbers from 2000 to today. And so, you know, in 2000, the census had the African-American population of the state at just under 29%. Today, the most recent census figures put that at about 32%. And so what you see is a growing African-American population. And then when you couple that with in-migration of other minority groups that also tend to trend Democratic, like Asian-Americans and Latinos. So we've seen a doubling of the Asian-American population in the state, and we've seen the Latino population in the state nearly double as well within the past, between 2000 and 2010.
So that pattern coincides with predicted political shifts. But 2000, that's exactly when things turned from blue to red in Georgia.
Or in 2002 in particular, to be specific. And so that was the culmination of more than 40 years of changing voting patterns among white Southerners.
So we have a voicemail from Jenny in Cleveland. She's a self-identified progressive in a conservative district.
And we hear stories about Democrats being a party of color, and yet up here, those that exist are all white people. So the coverage feels a little weird, and we, of course, feel very isolated from the rest of progressive crowd in the state.
So this is something we've heard a lot, Greg. You know, we're a blue dot in a red state. You've reported on shifting demographics. Where are you seeing those changes in Georgia?
You're seeing it, and you're really going to start seeing it, I think, this year with this election, because Stacey Abrams, the Democratic candidate for governor, is really focused on expanding the universe of likely Democratic voters. Her campaign really believes there's an expanding universe of maybe a million or more than a million left-leaning voters who don't generally cast ballots. And she is trying to get them to cast ballots this year with a blend of mostly progressive policies. And so you're seeing her campaign really staking putting all its bets on the fact that it can expand that universe while also energizing and getting liberals in Metro Atlanta, white liberals in the suburbs as well, and in some of these sort of, isolated blue dots to come out to the polls.
So what are you seeing in places where Trump lost, Fayette County, Gwinnett County? Is this a place to watch for changing from red to blue?
Yeah, Gwinnett County and Cobb County and Fayette County, but especially Gwinnett and Cobb County, are central to any Democratic hopes of flipping Georgia in November. These days, it was a surprise that both those counties flipped in 2016, but now it's sort of the backbone of any strategy for Democrats to retake the state.
Question for both of you. Fastest growing state in the South, growth of new industries, influx of people from tech, entertainment workers. Are they changing the electorate?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to be contributing to this new coalition that Stacey Abrams in particular hopes to build. And so in particular, part of the reason why Cobb and Gwinnett counties are shifting is that, one, migration patterns have changed for newer immigrant groups in the United States. So you no longer come through an inner city. Oftentimes, Latino and Asian American populations head straight for suburbia. And we've also seen in central cities like Atlanta, we've seen that the African-American population of these cities has declined. And oftentimes when people are leaving the city of Atlanta, they are going to the suburbs, and then they may be joined by newcomers who are coming from other places. And the other thing that's important to not exclude whites from this discussion is that when you have people coming in from new industries, they may not be coming from parts of the country that are traditionally conservative. They may be younger. And so all of these things may be contributing to a growing white liberal population as well. That does not negate the shift that happened amongst whites in the South after the 1960s. And so, I mean, that was a very real shift from whites who had been yellow dog Democrats who, you know, slowly shift their party identification to the Republican Party. It started in presidential elections, and then it culminated in 2002. With that shift to voting Republican in statewide elections as well. All of these things are coming together, and it's been giving the Democratic Party hope for the last 10 years that they could turn the state blue at some point.
So go ahead, Greg.
I was going to say that also helps explain some of the conservative angst over Amazon's second headquarters. It's much smaller population patterns, but if 50,000 new jobs would be created by that, and many of them from out of state, many of them tech workers that could be more liberal, who knows, there is some sort of pushback you hear, especially from outside of Metro Atlanta, about that changing Metro Atlanta's dynamics.
So how likely, however, is it Metro Atlanta's dynamics are going to change, especially if you're talking about an influx of reverse migration, bringing a lot more minorities into that sort of area?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the last two open city elections, we've seen a Republican / independent candidate, Mario Norwood, come within a few hundred votes of winning those races as Atlanta becomes a little bit more more whiter. But in general, you're also seeing Metro Atlanta, as we mentioned earlier, with those three core counties of Metro Atlanta all flipping blue. You're seeing Metro Atlanta become a little bit more liberal.
So how are the campaigns different than they were in 2016 or 2014 responding to these new populations?
Well, we're seeing, of course, with Abrams, an entirely different strategy. She has broken with, decade or so of conventional Democratic approach by, rather than saying we're going to appeal toward the moderate suburbanite who used to be a Republican voter, she's saying, we're happy to have those voters, but she's trying to energize mostly minority, left-leaning voters across the state. Whereas I think Brian Kemp is a much more conventional Republican strategy, trying to wring out as many Republican conservative votes as he possibly can, going by the same strategy that Nathan Deal used, that Sonny Perdue used in past gubernatorial elections.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the one thing that I'd add to that is that I guess it was probably 12, 13 years ago when I was working in D.C. as a pollster, when we did races in the South, we were still asking questions about how you identified yourself for national elections versus how you identified yourself for state and local elections. And it was because we were still kind of in that period where we weren't sure sort of whether or not that secular realignment among Southern whites had actually changed. Now, if you're going to vote Democratic or you're going to vote Republican in a presidential election, you're going to vote Republican in your state and local elections as well. And so it doesn't make sense for Democrats to continue to think that you can get Republican presidential voters to vote for you in statewide elections. And then there's also just this issue of if the base of the Democratic Party in Georgia is African-American and female, then why shouldn't African-American women be allowed to have their chance to be able to run for the offices, especially given in 2014 how poorly Democratic candidates did amongst white voters, where they actually underperformed amongst white voters, even though African-American voters voted for them at the rates that we would have expected them to.
That's Andra Gillespie. She's an Emory University professor. She's with us, along with Greg Bluestein from the AJC. He's a political reporter. We're talking about Georgia's changing political landscape. And, of course, Stacey Abrams is the key here in many ways. This is something that this is the candidate riding that tide of women candidates and also a blue wave that Democrats are hoping to be riding. And here are some others reported by CBS Evening News host Jeff Glore.
In Kentucky, former Marine pilot Amy McGrath won a hard-fought primary for a potential congressional seat. And in Texas, former Dallas County Sheriff Lupe Valdez became the state's first openly gay and Latina gubernatorial nominee from a major party.
So we have Ayanna Pressley, we have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Johanna Hayes. These are women who are pitching their campaigns and also producing videos that are about their personal story rather than their political stance, so to speak. What is behind that tactic, do you think? And how is that appealing to the voters that Democrats are trying to grab?
Well, I mean, I think there are a number of things to think about in terms of self-presentation. People are trying to present themselves in ways that hopefully match in some way what the values of a particular district are. So while Stacey Abrams is definitely a progressive, she's using her progressive policy stances to pitch bread and butter types of pragmatic issues. So she's not Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez by any stretch of the imagination. And if Ocasio-Cortez tried to run here in Georgia, she would lose. And so I think it's really important to kind of look to see sort of whether or not the candidate actually fits the jurisdiction in which they're running. And in all of these instances, we have seen places where they fit and their general election chances are actually molded by sort of how strong of a fit they actually are for the general electorate and not just the Democratic Party electorate.
So how about, go ahead, Greg.
I was going to say, one thing to add is also we're seeing this national trend where more women are running for U.S. Congress seats, more women running for Senate, more women running for gubernatorial seats. But also in Georgia, down the ticket, we have more women running for state legislative office than ever before, about 120 overall, including more Republican women, a smaller number than Democratic women, but about 30 Republican women running for state legislative seats. And we're seeing them try to navigate the sort of Trump era at the same time as running for public office.
And I think a part of it is that women are being asked to run and actually seeing themselves as viable candidates in ways that they hadn't been before. Oftentimes, one of the reasons why women are so underrepresented in elected offices in the United States is that women aren't socialized to run for office. And there have been grassroots organizations that have existed for decades now at this point. But that, coupled with the Women's March and the reaction to Trump, I think is getting women to have conversations about how they can make a difference by running for public office and putting themselves up for office in ways that we hadn't seen before.
So following other trends and populations that are going on nationally. So where does Georgia fit into these national trends, you know, especially if you're looking at the presidential election coming up in 2018?
Yeah, well, I mean, as we said, Georgia is sort of following the national trend. We have not only Stacey Abrams running for governor at the top of the ticket, but also female candidates on the Democratic side up and down the ballot, and one Republican statewide candidate, Tricia Pridemore, who's a recently appointed public service commissioner, but also watch those down ticket races. There are women running in a lot of competitive state legislative races poised to play a very big role in the next legislative session. And as Professor Gillespie mentioned too, they're raising cash in ways they didn't raise before. They're getting a lot of media attention. They're getting the sort of credibility behind their campaigns. because they're running in these competitive districts that weren't competitive 6 or 8 years ago, but are suddenly now right on the precipice.
Right. I did say presidential election of 2018. I meant in 2020. Whether or not Georgia is a test case, I guess, for 2020 is the question.
Yeah. We're losing some of that national attention because of the Florida race.
Right.
But this race between Abrams and Kemp in many ways is a test for 2020 because a lot of the same sort of ideological values that we might see in 2020 are being put to the test now. We've got a President Trump anointed candidate in Brian Kemp going against Stacey Abrams, who is endorsed not only by Hillary Clinton but also Bernie Sanders and many of the 2020 potential candidates on the Democratic side. And you're seeing a battle sort of play out on expansion of Medicaid, on more school funding, and on gun control in a major way in a state where Democrats have never really embraced, at least leading state Democrats have never really embraced gun control measures. Stacey Abrams is. And so this will be a big test of that philosophy as well.
But I mean, I think the test is sort of how well she does. And to go back to the first segment, I have to admit, I agree the fundamentals in the state still favor a Republican candidate. I would say it's a pink state. It's not ruby red.
But not purple.
We'll have to wait to see. And so, if this race becomes a 4-point race, basically, that we end up looking for a two-party vote standpoint to 58-42. One, at this point, I can't predict which one of them gets 52 and which one of them gets 48. But that actually does represent a certain level of competitiveness that I think we have to get used to. And that is what makes Georgia competitive. It's not a foregone conclusion that the Republican candidate wins a contest, in a cakewalk anymore. And that's probably not going to be the case for the near future.
So we have just a minute left. But even before I moved to Georgia a couple months ago, people were saying it's a blue state. It's going purple. It's blue. A lot of different predictions. How we just heard about Lee Atwater and the importance of messaging and strategy. Is there strategy in saying Georgia's going to become a blue state, either by Democrats or by Republicans who want to scare voters out to the polls?
Well, I mean, so when the Democratic Party of Georgia first started to say this, I started to become very cognizant of this around 2013. They were looking at the demographics, and I thought they were pinning their hopes on people who at the time were 15 years old and of color. And I was like, by 2018, they're probably not going to be your most reliable voters, but give them another 10 or 15 years and they might be. And if those partisan voting patterns still hold, then this is absolutely true. So, I think part of it is sort of calling things that aren't as though they were. But, it's not totally out of thin air.
Stacey Abrams likes to say, we are a blue state. We're just confused. We'll find out in November if that's the case.
Greg Bluestein, he's a political reporter for the AJC. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And also Andra Gillespie, assistant professor of political science. She's at Emory. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. But we do, of course, want to hear from you. If you're voting this election year, what are the issues that are on your radar? What kind of messaging are you hearing about why you should or shouldn't vote? Leave us a message. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can reach us on Twitter or on our Facebook group. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and LaRaven Taylor. Tyler Morris is our technical director, and Sean Powers is our senior producer. Don Smith edits the show, and our new theme song, is by Alex Christman and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought. Thank you.